we need to make conservation relevant to the places people work, live and play. Like, conservation just can't be something that is done in the back and beyond on conservation land or these remote sub-Antarctic islands. It needs to be done in places that are relevant to New Zealanders. So Predator Free is all about that. It's about making the predator control you do in your back garden contributing to a wider landscape scale. And that, you know, I'm kind of the first to admit that won't get us to eradication, but it will get a community of engaged and empowered people to help us achieve this goal, because this goal is going to be as much about the people as it is about the technical aspects of how we actually eradicate the predators.
Hello, kia ora, and welcome to the People Helping Nature podcast, brought to you by Conservation Amplified. Our show features the stories of people who are helping nature to bring more awareness to this amazing space. I'm Callum.
And I'm Anna, and today we're joined by Jessie Morgan. Kia ora, welcome to the People Helping Nature podcast.
Kia ora, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you here. To start, would you like to begin by introducing yourself and telling us a bit about how you're involved in the Predator Free movement?
Sure. So, kia ora everybody. I'm Jessie Morgan and I'm the CEO of the Predator Free New Zealand Trust. So we're an independent trust aimed really at helping and supporting individuals to participate in the Predator Free movement and to inspire others to get involved.
Thank you and welcome again. Before we kick off, can you please explain what Predator Free actually means? What does it represent for New Zealand and our future?
Yeah, so Predator Free New Zealand is an ambitious goal to remove mammalian predators from all of Aotearoa. And when I say mammalian predators, it can get a bit confusing. So what we're really talking about is possums, mustelids, so ferrets, weasels and stoats, rats, of which we have three species in New Zealand. We're very lucky. And also we talk quite a lot about feral cats because they have a huge devastating impact on our native species. So the reason we're trying to make New Zealand predator free is so our native wildlife can flourish, because they've evolved here without the presence of mammalian predators, and so they're defenseless really. So we're really about removing those predators so our native species can thrive. And our native species isn't just our birds. Like, I know we love our birds, but those predators have a huge impact on our insects and our bats and our frogs and even our plant life. So yeah, it's really important that we remove them so we can protect our precious taonga.
That's a really good answer. I think we definitely have quite vulnerable ecosystems when it comes down to the species level and how they form together because of that lack of mammalian predators. Upon human arrival, we did introduce these mammals. When did we begin to realize that this was a problem?
I think we realized really early. So I've read accounts of Maori actually before the Europeans arrived, actually changing their practices, because they introduced the Polynesian rat, so the kiwi, and also dogs. And they already very early on recognized the impact that those introduced predators were having on the ecosystem here. So let's say 1500. And then as we introduce other predators, English are great, aren't they? So they can't come to New Zealand and then they decide that they miss home a little bit. So they introduce rabbits and hedgehogs, and then the rabbits get out of control. So they introduce stoats and ferrets to control the rabbits. We introduce possum for fur trade. Gorse is a whole nother story, isn't it? But, you know, so there was an acclimatization society that was really set up to make New Zealand feel like home. And even as that was happening in the 1800s, there were kind of outcry from people knowing that it would be a bad idea. You know, it was kind of like, we just introduced the next predator and the next thing, and it took us a while to learn. So I think we've known for a long time. There's also a story about Cook's cat. I think it was in Fiordland, and it would walk down the rope of the boat, off the boat, walk into the bush, have a good feed, come back, you know, puke up some feathers or whatever on the boat. And they, and even at that stage, Cook and his crew realized how precious or how vulnerable our native species were to predation.
Wow.
That's such a crazy story, eh? And in hindsight, is such a beautiful sight sometimes. And I'm really glad that nowadays we know more and it's no longer a common practice to just introduce the predator of species X that's causing you some trouble. In New Zealand, what did we initially do about those predators once we stopped introducing the next mammal into our country?
Yeah, well, I guess the start of these national parks kind of happened in Fiordland, so on Resolution Island in Dusky Sound, 1891, the government made that a sanctuary. And you've probably heard the story of Richard Henry, who rowed his boat across the kind of treacherous sound, getting kakapo and kiwi from the mainland and putting them on this island to protect them. Because the stoat invasion was kind of, the wave was coming towards Fiordland. And unfortunately, in the 1900s, stoats did reach that island, and I don't know if they wiped out the kakapo from there, but they definitely, yeah, I'm pretty sure that did lead to the loss of the kakapo population there. So we did start doing some things, and then in about the 30s, they started doing predator control around Tairoa Head in the albatross colony there. So that was kind of interesting. I actually don't know how they did it. It would be really fascinating to look, like, were they using snare? They're probably using snares and live capture traps and, you know, things like that, trying to trap these animals that were impacting on the albatross breeding. So, yeah, we, you know, and New Zealand has this amazing history, I guess, of predator control. And we, because we're an island nation, we have this benefit of being able to remove predators from islands and them remaining safe unless we kind of unknowingly introduce them again. So the biosecurity on some of these islands is amazing. So you can remove predators, and once they're gone, native species can thrive there. And we have a real history in that island eradication space. So I think the first island's 1964 is Maria Island in the Hauraki Gulf. And that was a little 1 hectare island. And the local forest and bird group and a school, I think, kind of accidentally eradicated rats from their island by leaving a heap of Bredivacum come out because they knew there was a rat problem. So they put a heap, probably like far more than we ever want to know about. But then they came back and all the rats were gone. And so they were kind of, you know, they were like, oh, well, that's really successful. Now our seabirds can all breed and can be successful there. And then we kind of moved on. So that's 64. And then we moved on to Break Sea in 1988. So that's in Dusky Sound in Fiordland, or just outside of, where they also eradicated rats. Pretty sure rats, maybe stoats too, but rats. So we kind of build this history of eradications. Break Sea in 88, Kapiti Island 96, which is about 2,000 hectares. So we go from, or maybe Maria's 2 hectares. So 2 hectares in 1964, 170 in Break Sea in 88, and then 2,000 in 96. So every decade, we're really increasing our capacity. And the largest to date is 2001, is Campbell Island. So those sub-Antarctic islands, which I guess are so far away from mainland New Zealand, and the risk of someone accidentally introducing something pretty low, are so cool because they're like these kind of, I've heard them described as life rafts, really, in the sub-Antarctic ocean for our, all the seabirds. And New Zealand was a country of seabirds originally. But now we need to work out, how do we do that on the mainland? So how can we do that on Raki or on Stewart Island? That's quite challenging for lots of reasons. But how can we do these eradications around people? Because it's much easier when we're dealing with not having to deal with a human population on the islands. And New Zealanders, you know, those eradications really led to New Zealand being world class in that eradication field. And I think this is still the case, but there hasn't been an island eradication across the world without a New Zealander very high up in that, if not leading.
Wow. That is so
those eradications.
Cool.
which is, yeah, so cool. So, I mean, I was kind of proud that we're experts in mammalian invasion, but, you know, it'd be nice if we didn't have that problem to deal with.
It's amazing what we've done in those islands and just the lengths that the helicopter pilots went to and their level of planning. But a lot of what I think Kiwis connect with as predator-free, predator control is what we're doing on the mainland, because this is where people are living. And so how did the learnings from these early histories of predator control and predator eradication in New Zealand inform our approach today?
Well, I think it was only the 1990s where the Doc 200 was kind of designed and manufactured. So it's not that long ago since we've had that trap, and it was a game changer, really. Like, people could set that trap without too much fear of losing their arm, which I think the other traps beforehand were quite challenging.
Yeah, they're quite gnarly.
And so, but also I think you've hit the nail on the head, Callum, in that we need to make conservation relevant to the places people work, live and play. Like, conservation just can't be something that is done in the back and beyond on conservation land or these remote sub-Antarctic islands. It needs to be done in places that are relevant to New Zealanders. So Predator Free is all about that. It's about making the predator control you do in your back garden contributing to a wider landscape scale. And that, you know, I'm kind of the first to admit that won't get us to eradication, but it will get a community of engaged and empowered people to help us achieve this goal, because this goal is going to be as much about the people as it is about the technical aspects of how we actually eradicate the predators.
Yeah, it's so funny you say that. When I first got into conservation, I thought about, this is the species, this is a habitat job, or I say job, volunteering, and I never would have thought how heavily involved and how important the people are. When I look at conservation in general in New Zealand, and it's probably the same in other parts of the world, it's sometimes thought of as that's for the greenies in the corner, but it's about all of our heritage and all of our future. And I think we too often generalize it as something that's just an obligation, that's just there and we'll always have our forests. But it's not just that. And the benefits aren't just helping biodiversity if you're really that way inclined. It's a social thing. It's about healing mental health. There's just so many angles and importances and benefits of it that aren't spoken about. And yeah, I think it's awesome that we've got groups like Predator Free that are talking about all these different angles that are important.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating angle, isn't it? Like, we have a bit to do with Predator Free Wellington, so I'm based in Wellington. The social connection and resilient communities, the benefits to mental health, the just feeling like people are part of something bigger, all those things. I mean, biodiversity is awesome, but it doesn't actually get everyone excited. And so we need to, you know, it's really interesting once you see why people participate and why they continue to participate, because it's not always the biodiversity. It can be the cups of tea on a Sunday. It can be that they like walking and they like the, you know, the green time in the bush, walking a trap line. So all sorts of things. And they're all as worthy as each other, really. Like, biodiversity is a key outcome, but there's lots of other benefits along the way. Talking about that biodiversity aspect, I grew up in Wellington, and in the 90s here, I think there was like 8 tui. Now I have 8 tui in my like camellias and my kawhai tree and my whijoa, you know, like that. We just have tui and kaka everywhere here, which it's just such a big change. And it's this kind of change in the biodiversity returning to the places that we work and live. I like to think of one is the mainstreaming of conservation, because it's like you see them every day as you walk past the supermarket type thing. But it's the mainstreaming of it, but it's also the normalizing of conservation and of those species and having to live alongside them. You know, it's such a cool problem to have that they're, and in some ways they're doing their own sales and marketing, right? When you've got 4 tui in your back garden or 8 tui in your back garden, you're thinking, I've got a responsibility here for my cat not to, you know, empty that nest or to hunt those birds, or I've got a responsibility to provide a safe habitat by trapping rats here, you know. So I think it engages people in different ways.
Yeah. Speaking of sales and marketing, I'll take the TUI's jingle over the radio jingles any day.
It's true. It's like the Kaka, however, a bit more screechy. Yeah. So, you know, you get a band of, we call them the Bogan Kakas. They're just like, they're just, yeah, over the city. But no, they're great. And, you know, I've got a few kids and sometimes a few too many. But it's really interesting what they notice, because I've grown up here and I still get excited by TUI and they're a little bit apathetic because there's so many of them. But when we go to different places, they quite often say, why are there no birds here? So they notice the absence. And I think there's a great quote that I will probably butcher by David Attenborough about, we can't care about the things we've never experienced. And I think that's true. If you aren't used to having TUI and kaka and lizards in your back garden, how can you care and take action if you don't know what they are?
Oh, completely.
Yeah, and that is so true. And I love how Wellington as the capital has really stepped up because of so many reasons and is living that dream. And if I talk about predator free, Wellington usually is the first thing on the mainland that comes to mind, because it just seems to be working like a well-oiled machine. But before we head too far into the topic, the Predator Free New Zealand Trust, how did that actually evolve and how did it form and why is that important?
Yeah, so the Predator Free New Zealand Trust formed in 2013. And it was really off the back of a man called Sir Paul Callaghan. And there was some kind of other action around the same time, basically saying, this is our moonshot, you know, this is for New Zealand. It's worth us having a really good go at this, because we don't know, because it is possible if we kind of have a laser focus campaign here and coordinate our resources. So that led to a man called Rob Fenwick. He was probably the part of the momentum of making this happen, and Gareth Morgan, and I think at the time it was Al Morrison was the DG, Director General of the Department of Conservation, and those guys got together and said, hey, there's heaps of community groups out there doing really good work, but we've actually got no idea where they are or what they're doing, and they've got no idea that there's another group just down the road. So they were like very siloed. There was very little information sharing between them. And there wasn't even really a clear understanding of who was doing what where. So that's kind of what we set out to do, is like, how do we celebrate the great work these groups are doing? How can we give them better access to information to ensure that we're not working in silos, that we're sharing information? And then how do we coordinate in, I guess, with the agencies, and regional council's a big player in this space, obviously, too. So that was 2013. And then in 2016, John Key made an announcement about Predator Free 2050 as a government strategy, which was great news for us, because it just helped kind of bring everything together and kind of catalyze a bit more activity. But we were obviously been up for a few years and kind of in a good place to... We had a running start, if you know what I mean, when that was announced in 2050. So since then, we've continued to be really focused on the community side, supporting individuals to take predator control action in their backyards or in their kind of communities. But we work really closely with the Department of Conservation and Predator Free 2050 Limited, which is very confusing. I know that they have the same name. And so 2050 Limited, as we call them, that was established in 2016 as well. Well, they didn't get up and running till 2018, I don't think. But their key role is to fund large landscape scale projects and breakthrough science. So they've been the core funder of projects like Predator Free Wellington, Predator Free Dunedin, Waiheke Project. They now fund about 19 projects around the country, thanks to some extra funding from Jobs for Nature. And so they were really our pilot projects of learning how we can do this on the mainland, because we're quite good at doing it on islands, but doing it on the mainland in kind of productive landscapes with farms or in urban environments where everyone owns a like quarter acre if they're lucky, you know, and like, so this patchwork approach has been a real challenge, but we need to be able to do it in those landscapes if we're going to achieve it across the whole country.
So that's really interesting. In many ways, it was like the map wasn't there for who's doing what around the country, and some of it was clearing the fog of what you were doing, of who's doing what out there, what are their needs, what are their gaps, and then how do we empower them. And so there's Predator Free New Zealand Trust Limit. There's Predator Free 2050 Limited. There are Predator Free regional hubs like Wellington, Dunedin, etc. Are there any other predator-free named organizations? Because I understand if you're not involved in this space, it must get really confusing.
It gets really confusing. I think like the first week of induction of any new staff member is like, who are all these entities called predator-free? And what's your relationship and what do they do? I mean, I actually think that's a cool thing about predator-free, like that it's not kind of, there's no trademark around it, right? So everyone can use the term predator-free. So you can have predator-free Miramar, or predator, so you can go quite granular, you know, so you can, so there's lots of suburbs around the country called predator free Waihee, or predator, it's probably not a suburb, but you know what I mean? Like lots of different predator free Newlands and predator free Ara Valley and Wellington. So we haven't been really precious about that name because I think we all need to connect over this kind of vision for New Zealand Inc. And it does get a little bit complicated, but I think all the different parties kind of try and work together, and we try and make that term predator free. People just really understand what that is.
Yeah, it definitely describes exactly what we're about, right? What the mission is about. You couldn't be any clearer. And you already touched on it. It's so crucial to bring it all together because the mainland is divided in so many different areas, the farms, the cities. You really have to be a team to bring it to life. But to focus in on Predator Free New Zealand Trust, what I love about it is it's pragmatic, it's action orientated, and very much grassroots. What do you guys do on a daily basis, on a day-to-day basis, and why?
It's a really good question. Part of this is telling really good stories about people doing cool work to encourage and inspire other people to get involved. So we tell stories about farmers, and hopefully other farmers see that and say, hey, that's not actually that hard. I could do that or implement that on my farm. Or businesses getting involved, community groups, schools, scout halls, you know, like we're just trying to showcase that there's so many different people involved here. So we run a website, and our social media channels on Instagram and Facebook are probably our biggest channels. And so part of it is just highlighting the cool work and of others. And it's all for me, it's all about the others. Like it's all about people on the ground doing the work. It doesn't matter about us. We're just kind of the facilitator and try and kind of amplify what other people are doing, because they're doing much cooler work than we are in our office in Wellington. But so part of it is that, and then part of it is kind of how do we make the material and information and expert advice accessible for people wanting to get involved. So how do we remove the barriers at different steps? And that's really interesting because everyone's in a different part of their journey. Like they kind of start off and say, well, I don't think I've got any rats in my backyard. And you're saying, well, put this chew card out for a week and see what happens. And it comes back, there's no chew card left because the rats just eat the core flute. So a chew card's kind of core flute infused with peanut butter or some other tasty substance. And you're meant to be able to interpret the bite marks. But if you've got a high rodent population or hedgehogs or possums or whatever, they destroy those cards. And so then people think, oh, I do have something in my back garden, you know, or it's living in my compost. So what can I do? And so it's at just at different stages. Like that's a very different scale from someone doing 9,000 hectares, for example, in the Holyford, where we were just talking about earlier, the Holyford Valley in Fiordland, they're managing traps over a 9,000 hectare area, mainly targeting stoats, but also rats and possums. And so how they technically, what they do at that scale and how they run that program is very different from someone doing it on a lifestyle block or a school. So all that different kind of information, a lot of that information's out there, but it's in these really complicated technical documents aimed at professionals. So how can we, as the grassroots movement grows and people increasingly become aware of the impact that these introduced predators are having, they want to do something about it. And so we want to make it really easy for people to get involved. So we run an online shop, for example. And the reason we set that up years ago is we had everyone, we were writing all these stories and like, that's cool, I want to buy a trap. And we're like, oh yeah, that's really hard. Don't ask that question. And so then we set up this trap, this shop. And in the early days, actually, we had a lot of doc staff coming in from head office in Wellington saying, oh, I've always wanted to buy a trap. And we were showing doc staff how to use traps, which was quite funny in hindsight. It just showed how difficult it was to actually, that supply chain wasn't set up for consumers. And so we, you know, that's a barrier that we tried to reduce. And now increasingly people can buy their trapping equipment locally because there's so many community groups, but we still run the shop as a bit of a backup in terms of when people can't get access to that trap. So very long-winded answer to your what do? I do a lot of stuff. We work a lot with the Department of Conservation, Predator Free 2050, and just trying to, like, we're trying to collaborate. We need to be efficient with our resources here and spending and what money we're spending. So we need to share knowledge and make sure we're not reinventing the wheel all the time. And so how do we do that? We have a great saying that we hope everyone in Predator Free will take up, which is there's no IP in Predator Free.
I like it.
Nice.
Yeah, and it's true, right? We're here, we're all aiming for the same end goal. So there's no point in protecting your secret bait recipe or your secret trapping because you get more rats. It's like we're all trying to capture these, you know, these rats. So if there's a better way of doing it, we should share it.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I think you're very broad reaching in the scope of what you do, but I love how it's so focused on how do we remove the barriers to getting to the outcome of removing our invasive predators. A couple of things you said, you talked about amplifying the great stories of predator free and conservation, I guess, in general. And that quite aligns quite well with us because their charity is called Conservation Amplified. And so I got quite a bit of joy out of reading through your website, seeing I outside of this work here, I'm a content marketer and marketing person by day job. That's what pays the bills. And I love your website because you have so many good quality resources and guides. And creating content takes a lot of work. And so hats off to you for all these really good resources that are practical and actionable. But what I really like about the Predator Free website is that it's not just pie in the sky. Imagine this. It's really actionable content, how to set up a trapping group, how to apply for funding, here's how to use a dock trap, etc. Lots and lots of stuff for all different groups, educators, farms, communities, individuals in your backyard. If you're at any stage of your journey and you're thinking, how do I get involved, highly recommend going to the Predator Free website and checking it out. What is the website? How do they find it?
Yeah, so our URL is predatorfreenz.org, and you're right, we've been growing that website for a long time, so there's a heap of content on there. And the challenge for us is how we kind of keep it manageable for people to find what they're looking for at different stages. But yeah, it is about making it accessible. Like you said this, you said it earlier that we can't have this have conservation being the preserve of the greenies. It needs to be a mainstream activity. So we can't use acronyms. We can't expect prior knowledge. You know, we have to make this simple. And I think it can be simple. It's really easy to get involved and to start doing predator control on your bush block on your farm or in your riparian planting, whatever. And there's a lot of knowledge, hopefully, on the site for people to find different things out.
Now, there definitely is. And one thing that a lot of diehard conservationists, myself probably included sometimes too, is we bombard people with chapter 20 because that's where we're at in our own journey, right? And facts, facts, facts. But what I love about the Predator Free website, there's, like you said, so many different levels, and it's just about getting that curiosity up. And
starting
there's,
at chapter one, yeah.
Yeah, there's so many possibilities to start at chapter one, and also different species, not only focusing on the birds. I think that's amazing, and that's important, and we often miss that as a collective of conservation.
I think that's right. And I think, like, often people, the first step here might be that there's rats in their compost bin. And so it's not about biodiversity and it's not about native species, but it's about, yuck, I don't want these rats in my compost bin. I definitely don't want them inside my house. So how can I kind of rat proof my compost bin and control predators? And then they notice, like, the plants are coming back or the native species are coming into their garden more. And so they're suddenly like, oh, maybe I could do some native planting. So I often think of predator free as the gateway drug into conservation. You know, it's some easy steps that you can take before you become a fully fledged conservation nerd.
And it totally is. And in the last 5 years, I've seen conservation evolve. And part of that was the Jobs for Nature Fund. And a lot of those jobs went to people who weren't conservationists and helped transform them into advocators. How did you kind of observe that movement? How did that help Predator Free in particular?
Yeah, so for the trust, actually, we ran a program through that, through Jobs for Nature, called the Predator Free Apprenticeship Program. And what was so cool about that is we started with this kind of vision of growing the future leaders of the predator-free movement, because by the time it's 2050, I'm going to be quite old. And so we need the young ones to come through, and they're going to be our decision makers, and they're going to be our the people on the ground. So for us, we were able to deliver this 2-year program, which was, you know, a walk alongside program. So the apprentices were placed with experienced pest control specialists. Because the other thing you notice in the space is everyone's quite old, like a lot older than me old. And so you get all these old, typically old white guys that came through the forestry service or what the wildlife service, and are now have got this huge amount of knowledge. But we needed to work out how we impart some of that knowledge and share that with this younger generation coming through and inspire that young generation that a career in predator control and conservation, there is a cool career path there, that it's not just a volunteer thing. There's actually a decent, you know, it's not a holiday job. It's something you can do for the rest of your life. So we set up this program, and unfortunately we don't have any further funding for that. So we've put about 65 people through a 2-year program, and some of them are just phenomenal. They're so inspiring and so cool to have watched their development and growth, and I really look forward to kind of watching where they will go in the future, because they will be the future leaders of this movement. But in general, Jobs for Nature funded a phenomenal number of projects around the country, and not all of them, in fact the majority of them, probably don't have sustainable ongoing funding. So we're gonna see this retraction in some ways and in the next few years of those projects, which is a real shame, because I've been able to take on a lot more, especially young Māori. Actually, a lot of these projects were iwi or hapu led, and so we're really connecting young Māori back to place, and we're bringing them, that program was able to bring them home and give them jobs in their kind of near their family and near in their rohe that they were connected to, that they whakapapa to. So it's really sad seeing that go, actually. It's really a quite emotional, especially that kind of connection for hapu back to place. And yeah, I don't know how that's gonna play out. From a kind of conservation point of view, I think hopefully some of it will be able to continue, but I don't think all of it will be able to, because, you know, there's this thing that once you stop, especially in predator control, not so much in planting, but you can, someone, Cam Speedy, actually, who's one of the people we work really closely with and is a phenomenal ecologist and pest control specialist, he talks about this rubber band theory. So you kind of do your predator control and you stretch the rubber band, and when the rubber band's stretched, your predator control numbers, predators are low and your bird species can thrive. But as soon as you stop with the effort of holding that rubber band out, returns to the state, you know, its neutral state. And unfortunately with predator control, unless we stay on top of it, we lose the gains that we've made. So, which I guess is another reason for the whole predator free movement, is that we do this huge effort up front to remove predators once and for all, and then we break the rubber band and we don't have to maintain that effort. There's so much effort at the moment into suppressing the number of predators, so our, you know, for a whole range of reasons. But imagine if we didn't even have to do that suppression level effort anymore.
Absolutely. That would be a dream come true for so many people. And I fully see that when we increase the carrying capacity of our land, if we don't remove the predators, we're just giving them more food to eat and bounce back with. The Jobs for Nature funding has been so powerful. You've had your apprentice program. I know you went through a cadet program
similar,
helped set up your career with Bay Conservation Alliance. But a big topic is the end of Jobs for Nature funding, and this is a real worry within the industry, within the sector, should I say. How do we adapt to having more conservation capabilities and willingness to take action, but less funding? We can't just rely on volunteers to do everything. I mean, it's great to have volunteers, but that's not a long-term strategy. Your organization recently commissioned the Empowering Action Report, which surveyed more than 300 community conservation groups to get a fresh perspective on the sector, especially now that this funding is drying up. What were the key takeaways you found, and do you have any thoughts on how our space needs to evolve to meet the changing reality?
Yeah, so that report was done by Marie Dool, an awesome researcher, and she's done a great job of pulling that report together. So we did that report with Marie, and I mean, not that surprising in a lot of ways. It's like funding is really hard to come by, and there's some frustrating parts of the funding system that make it difficult for groups. And so I think there's a bunch of work that funders themselves can do to make their application process easier, to make their reporting align with someone else's reporting, so you don't have to write 10 different funding reports. You could write the same one aligned to the same time frame, you know, that type of thing. So there's some kind of core administrative stuff that we're just not getting right. I think the other insight from that report for me was that it's really hard for funders to understand how to fund conservation. How do they measure it? Because, you know, I use this analogy relatively often, but if you fund art, street art, for example, you fund a sculpture, it's in place and it's done and it's delivered, and so, and it's there in perpetuity. But you fund conservation and it's harder because you have to keep funding it to keep maintaining the gains, you know, in the current climate. And so being able to tell a really clear story to funders of the impact that they're having, what we're measuring, what the outcomes are, I think that's really, really key for us to kind of increase the amount of funding and funders willing to fund in this conservation sector, because it is complicated, you know, like people don't know exactly what they're going to get from the money that they're going to donate and what's the ongoing impact that has. The other thing I guess that was interesting in that report was, which will come as no surprise really to people in the space, but there we are operating in a kind of funding scarce environment. And so given the end of Jobs for Nature and some of these kind of blips, how do we get smarter about using the funding that's there? So one of the recommendations that Marie had was around these regional hubs. So like Bay Conservation Alliance, which is a bit of a platform for support or an umbrella organization, however you want to describe that. But these regional hubs help minimize the administration burden on their groups. And they also, at a regional level, connect people locally and ensure that they're getting up-to-date knowledge or they know what funds are opening. And, you know, the hubs all kind of have their own unique identity and what they deliver for their kind of community. But I think that better connectedness within the whole system is really important. And in some ways, that's what the predator-free movement has done. It's kind of enabled us to have this laser focus across a range of organisations and agencies and groups so that we can better work together with a focus, a central focus. And I think that's one of the keys to the success of predator-free so far, is actually multiple organisations working together on the same thing and kind of sharing and collaborating.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree with everything you just said. It's, to me, we're a team, and predator-free 2050 is only going to be achieved if we continue to work as a team. And those hubs are amazing, and places like your website to get more people on that train are also amazing, because it's only going to happen as a collective. Looking into the future, how are we tracking at this moment to achieve predator-free 2050?
Great question. So what has been amazing in this journey? So I've been with the Trust for 10 years and maybe 11 now, but the grassroots movement is super strong, and the willingness and involvement at a community level. New Zealanders want this. They want it to happen. And lots of people are showing action, you know, taking action. That's their way of kind of supporting the movement. The wider sector, I think we've got some work to do in terms of how do we work better together more effectively and efficiently. But it's so much better than it was 10 years ago. You know, 10 years ago, DOC and Regional Council didn't even know when they were doing predator control operations beside each other. They didn't have that kind of those channels of communication. So I think we're getting much better at becoming aligned and connected. And this stuff takes quite a long time. I'm quite impatient, come from kind of a commercial background, so I'm not used to working at government pace. But getting big organization talking to big organization in an effective way, it actually takes quite a scarily long time. So that part, I think we've still got some work to do, but it is tracking in the right direction. The part that's also really exciting is the projects and research and development space. So we've got all these projects around the country that have been doing phenomenal work, really. There's great, you know, been huge progress in Waiheke with removing stoats, and they're kind of struggling with the last few stoats, which is really frustrating. But we will get there. It's just a matter of like trying to stay ahead of the stoats and catch those last few. And so you've got that. You've got this phenomenal project down in South Westland from Zero Invasive Predators, and that's been really trying to eliminate kind of stoats, rats, and possums from this. I think it's about 100,000 hectares, might be 80,000, something like that. And they're using natural barriers to prevent the reinvasion of predators back into the space that they've cleared. So we've got this cool tech. New Zealand is known for its number 8 wire kind of innovation, and I think that's what's going to get us there. We really need to be challenging our current tools and techniques of how we're applying those tools and just getting better. And there's some great people with their who have turned their kind of brains to this. And so I think we're progressing, but we're still in the stage of like learning how to do it. I think that's what people, I think, assumed that this would be a kind of a relatively straight line trajectory from, you know, clearing one area to clearing the whole country. But we don't actually know how to do it. There's no recipe. So we need to learn how to do it and learn how to do it in different landscapes, which is more challenging, I think, than most people realize. These things are pests for a reason. They've been pests for, you know, hundreds or thousands of years, and they breed fast and they adapt fast. And we just need our smartest Kiwis thinking about how we stay ahead of them.
Yeah, I love that. It sounds like we thought it would be a linear process where we would, you know, knock out achievements throughout the years towards 2050 in a pretty straight line approach, whereas it's probably more like an exponential change when you have the groundswell of the community, when you have less predators in an area and you're able to focus on eradicating the final few, and when you have technology, you can do so much more. So thinking about technology, there have been some amazing innovations, some really cool new technologies. Are there any particular technologies that you're excited about at the moment?
Yeah, I think the AI aspect of this is really, really interesting. And so obviously Good Nature Traps, maybe, I don't even know how long ago, that might be 15 years ago, they kind of invented this resetting trap, which was a game changer, because normally, you know, like a mouse trap, you catch something and it's inactive until that thing is cleared. So Good Nature kind of pioneered this resetting trap, which means the animal falls out of it and it's ready to go again to catch the next critter that comes along. And so that's really being built on by a whole range of providers now, this resetting technology to minimise the people effort that's required to go and clear a trap line or whatever. So take that and you merge that with some AI tech. And so you suddenly go, oh, this is a Kia in this trap. I better not kill it because this is one of the things we're trying to save. And so being able to identify the species we're targeting and the species we're not targeting is a real game changer. If you live in an area without kaka and kia, I think in some ways you're quite blessed with your predator control, because those things, those birds really are their own worst enemy. They like break into Dot 200 traps and they like this. I mean, we love them because they're so quirky, but they're very frustrating. And I know in Dunedin, the Predator Free Dunedin project had a whole bunch of problems with kaka in their traps and other devices. And so how that AI being able to say, we're not going to kill this kaka. You know, social license here and is really important. And so if we are killing the things we're trying to save, or we're killing people's companion cats or whatever, we're not going to be able to continue to do the work we do. And so it's really important we conscious of the impacts that we're having, kind of unintended consequences, I guess. And so the AI stuff is really cool. The other thing that is very interesting is there's this rat specific toxin, and so that is going through the EPA at the moment. They license and check all our toxins and other things. And so there's a toxin called norbormide, and that only impacts rats. So in terms of the power of that, we don't have to think about what if the birds eat it, or what if a dog eats it, or what if something, you know. So because it really specifically targets rats, I don't even think it gets mice, which is fascinating. So it just gives us this ability to be more specific in what we're targeting with certain tools. That the remote communication of devices in terms of them talking to each other and being able to talk to each other, but also the information out to whoever's monitoring that network. So that might be, you've got an area like the area in South Westland that's been cleared of stoats and rats. And so then they see a stoat on a camera, and that gets automatically sent back to the person monitoring, you know, sitting on their couch back in Franz Josef or whatever, rather than waiting for a month till someone goes out and clears the SD card from that camera and goes, oh, there was a stoat here a month ago. It's like, it's actually useless. I mean, it's interesting. Maybe there's a stoat back in the network, but by that point, you don't know where it is.
And you also don't know how, you might have more if it's a pregnant female too. So you might be behind.
Absolutely. So getting that timely information is really key, and also minimizing the workload. If you've got live capture traps out on a farm environment or something, or you've got Kia that you set off these traps or whatever, you know which traps you need to go to on a certain day. So you can say, oh, trap 5 and trap 27, we'll go past them while we're, you know, doing other stuff out on the farm. So rather than having to check every trap daily, being able to check the traps that have gone off and then reset them is just really valuable and just smart. You know, it just makes us work smarter, not harder.
Definitely. And interesting when I think about working smarter, not harder with technology, combining with the thoughts around the empowering action report, that a lot of the solutions we can look towards for the future of Predator Free is how do we coordinate our resources, our management, our human management, the forms we have to fill out to avoid duplication of resource. Efficiency is really where it's at. You know, we're seeing great efficiency gains, but with more efficiency, we can pour more investment on the fire, or the predator-free fire, so to speak, and get even better results. So conservation is often seen as a cost rather than an investment. For example, we spend billions of dollars on built infrastructure like roading, but only invest a fraction of that into our natural capital. What needs to change to ensure that we have enough resources invested in predator-free, keeping in mind that we need to improve our efficiency? And more importantly, how do we ensure that that's for a long enough period so we don't have these sugar hits of 5 years of hundreds of millions of funding and then slow down? How do we do that so that we have the foundation to make a lasting difference?
I think being really clear on the wider benefits of predator-free is really important here. So if we link it to kind of climate change impacts, we link it to fresh water, to preventing kind of livestock diseases, forestry, you know, like if we think much broader than it's just about biodiversity, I think we get a much broader buy-in. And I'm not saying biodiversity isn't important, but if you think of, because it's hugely important, but if you think of a lot of the people here in the decision making, we need to have we need to take a really wide approach here, that we're you know, the lost production in primary sectors, the economic benefits, the mental health and well-being, the connected communities and community resilience, as well as the biodiversity stuff. So I think taking a really broad, telling that really broad impact story or return on investment story, I think is going to be really key for us in terms of ongoing investment. And then, you know, I think this is where the grassroots and the people power comes into it, because politicians are actually going to listen to their constituents and they're going to listen to the people on the ground. So if your local MPs know that this is important to the people who are going to vote them in, then they're going to continue to support and this is an ongoing project. And I think we are seeing that, you know, like you see these really impressive groups all around the country and they're talking to MPs and the MPs are understanding what they're doing and why they're doing it and the wide range of benefits. So, you know, I don't think there's a silver bullet here, you know, for funding or for ongoing support, but I think the more people who are bought into it and value this outcome and can see the benefit, the really wide benefit that Predator Free brings, I think the more likely we are to kind of get the funding that's required and the ongoing support from, you know, right through the stack from politicians, decision makers, etc.
Sure.
Yeah, totally agree. I think we're kind of back to, we have to be a team, we have to be broad, involve people for that movement to happen and to achieve our goal. So let's say it's 2050, Team Aotearoa New Zealand has succeeded. We are predator free. What does this look like for the people, for nature, and for our economy?
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, we're more resilient against climate change. We've got biodiversity thriving in the places we work and live. We're not having to undergo this continual kind of suppression exercise of kind of predator control, but we will be monitoring at the borders. You know, we're going to need some biosecurity at a border level, but that we're an island, so that should be relatively straightforward, to be honest. We also need to think a bit about companion cats, and so I think companion cats will be at home on laps or safe and happy on people's properties. And that's going to take a bit of change, I think, because, you know, we've got this culture of letting our cats roam. And I think that our maturity around our what responsible cat ownership looks like will be will have changed, much like it has with dogs, to be honest. And so we've got that element. We've got thriving ecosystems and thriving national parks. And, you know, the thing with predator free is I am really realistic that this is also not a silver bullet for our ecosystem. There's heaps of other issues out there in terms of climate and water and ungulates and, you know, and weeds and all sorts. But predator control is something that we can kind of, it's really tangible and it's something that we know how to do, and we can do this across the nation. So yeah, it'll be a great day, won't it, when we get rid of all those introduced predators from across Aotearoa.
I can't even find words on how exciting that would be. I think it's a problem. It's very unique to islands such as New Zealand. And you already touched on it. We New Zealanders, Kiwis, we are the experts in this field because we are actively tackling it. We know it's achievable. And I think there's nothing but positive to say about succeeding and achieving that goal. You're totally right. It's not the silver bullet either. There's other problems within New Zealand, but you know, stopping to think about killing because we've saved them from that very threat of predation, I think that would be an amazing first step. And then we can think more saving, and go from there.
We need to give our native species the best chance they have at survival, and removing introduced predators from their environment is the key thing that we can do in terms of giving them more resilience against climate change and changing land use and things like that. So I think actually removing that threat of predation does a huge, gives them a huge leap forward in terms of securing their populations into the future.
And I always love to think about it in a way that we're fixing our own mistakes. We're restoring the balance that New Zealand had before human arrival. And I think that's something that's crucial for our biodiversity to keep on thriving.
It is. I mean, that's something we talk about quite a lot, that these, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this actually out loud, but these predators are amazing. They're such cool creatures, and they are just in the wrong place. And so we're really big on treating these animals with respect and humanely getting rid of them, and not, you know, we shouldn't kind of demonize them, because it's actually not their fault. They're there. Our ancestors or like other people brought them to New Zealand. And unless humans take action to remove them, nothing else is going to reduce those populations. And so we have a responsibility here, you know, to do something about it, because it's a mistake we've made.
Definitely. We had a few episodes back, we had Sam Gibson, Sam the Trap Man, on, who loves to communicate and educate in the space. And one thing he said was stoats are a taonga species, a treasure to England. Possums are a taonga species to Australia. These animals didn't choose to be here. And there are stoat preservation societies in England that are there to think about, you know, to care for these animals. And I really like that perspective. But I'm just putting my grey-haired, elderly Callum hat on of 2050. We've removed all these predators. We've got all the benefits. It's amazing. What's next? What are we doing after that for conservation?
Yeah, good question. Well, you know, our weed problem is relatively significant too. But I mean, I think just getting New Zealanders to really care and understand the native system, the native ecosystems that we either live amongst or, you know, go and enjoy. Like, we need to make sure we're valuing those and looking after them for the future. You know, we need to make sure there's healthy seedlings coming through, so we've got good forest health, and those forests aren't going to collapse due to there being no understory. We've got a lot of things we can work on, but you know what we're seeing in some of these places, like Predator-Free Miramar, where they have no rats there anymore. We've seen the community really move into engaging with the species, so they're kind of reporting the different species that are coming back that they're now seeing that they didn't used to see. We're seeing this kind of monitoring, for want of a better word, you know, monitoring of the native species, but they're also on high alert. If they see a rat, they know that shouldn't be there. And so we need the kind of eyes and ears of people on the ground to say, this thing shouldn't be here. And so kind of to be able to raise the alert to the appropriate response team. So, yeah, I mean, it is challenging. It's not going to be it's not going to solve climate change, is it, Predator-Free? But it does help create a happier, you know, a happier, healthier ecosystem that's more resilient to the changes that are going to be thrown at it from all over.
Right, yeah, I like that. I like that. So coming back to today, 2024, at the time of this recording, late 2024, what are some practical actions and tips that people can do today to help with Predator-Free?
Yeah, just get involved. So, you know, to start with, the easiest thing you can do is start doing predator control around your own property and your own community, so your local reserve. Encourage others to get involved, to, you know, talk to people about it. Often we hear these stories of like people getting into it because their neighbour complained all the rats came from their property and or from their compost bin, or coming into their, you know, and so it's like this great neighbourhood connection. But yeah, get involved, support it in any way that's appropriate to you. So that might just be appreciating the native species that are kind of in your local area and kind of becoming aware of what's there and what shouldn't be there. or what's missing. You know, I think what's missing is the key thing here too, if you understand that, you know, if you take the Wellington stat about tui here, so I never knew growing up that tui were missing from here, but now they're just thriving, and obviously as soon as they get the opportunity to, they will thrive. So what's missing in your local area, and how can you help bring that back? But get involved with your local community group too, if that's your buzz. Like, there's so many groups and communities out there that are really welcoming, looking for volunteers. So we've got a national map on our website that helps you find a group. And so if you go on that and kind of drill down to your area, you should be able to find a community group near you. And that's not for everyone. Like, everyone's kind of, some people, that's their worst fear, getting involved in a community group. So just being able to do things in their own backyard is great. And schools can get involved. It really, you know, like, and some of those community groups are looking for graphic designers or accountants or, you know, like strategists for their business plans, all that type of thing. So I think sometimes we think predator free, I can only help if I really like going out into the, you know, back and beyond and clearing manky rats out of traps. But actually, these groups are hungry for other skills and talent. And so there's a real gap here around professional volunteerism, I think, in terms of how businesses can kind of support local community groups with kind of free graphic design or printing or, yeah, there's a real, I think there's a role for everyone. So
definitely.
So before we wrap up, Jessie, I've got one big question for you. What does conservation mean to you?
Goodness, save the hard one to last. It's funny because we use the word conservation, and I wonder whether we should use the word restoration, because we shouldn't be conserving what's left, but we need to be restoring and making it bigger than what we've got, you know? So I do wonder sometimes if we've got the wrong word. But anyway, digress on your topic. I think conservation to me is caring about the native world around you. And I think I'm not a bird nerd, or I don't even think of myself as a conservationist, actually. And so I kind of ended up in this space because it's so much about people and connection to place and community. There's so much more than just the birds and plants and other species, you know. It's like we're all in this one ecosystem together, and we need to make sure we as humans, I guess, aren't taking more from than our share from the rest of the ecosystem. So I think it's thinking about us being connected into the wider picture, and how we can help contribute and kind of help connect other people into that too, because often, you know, we're not aware that things are special or rare, or how lucky we are to see things. And I think sharing that knowledge with others is super important too.
Definitely, definitely. I like that. It's been such a pleasure chatting with you, Jessie. I've certainly learned quite a lot. We're really grateful that you've taken the time out of your busy schedule to meet with us. So thank you for joining the show. And I hope you as the audience have also learned a thing or two.
Yeah, kia ora. Thank you, Jessie.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been great.